Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints, and you are so lucky to be here this morning. Of course, if the snow would stop and the sleet would go away and the sun would shine, everybody would be so much happier. But it doesn't really matter because we're going to make the sun shine right now because we're doing a second interview with Spotlight Andrea Kane, and we're going to talk about Samantha. So if you think Lady Alexandria was something else and Drake was something else, wait till you meet Samantha Barrett, and wait till you meet, well, you'll meet Remington very soon. So good morning, Andrea. How are you today?
Just cold like you are. How are you?
Freezing, even though I'm inside. It's cold up here. I don't know why.
It's it is.
Really freezing. Yeah, it's freezing here. So Samantha, it was written after, I take it, My Heart's Desire, right?
Yes, several years later, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so give everybody a background of the first one that hasn't read that yet, because if they didn't, they really need to, and then we can talk about Samantha.
Thank you. Okay, well, basically, you have a situation in Regency, England, where you have a young aristocratic woman, which is Alexandria, and she is about to embark on her first London season. She has no desire to. So she stows away on a boat, a merchant ship, heading for Old York, which is now Toronto. And she was off to see her father, who was the governor there, and to live there and to play and do all the cool things she wanted to do and not have to deal with the rigidity of the life that they wanted for her parents. So she was off thinking it was going to be a wild adventure, but she encountered a different kind of adventure by running into the captain, Drake Barrett, who has different sides to him, but that's, you know, all included in the book. But between the two of them, the sparks flew, and they had an at-sea adventure and an on-land adventure, both in Canada, both in England, and it's a pretty sparks-flying kind of a book.
It is. It's a great flying book. It's sort of like so romantic, and it just everybody will believe in maybe something again. So tell us about Samantha. When creating Samantha, how does she change from the first book to the second? Because she reminds me of my sister, actually. And I read it. I said, if my sister were here, she would fit her perfectly because she's impetuous and does what she wants and doesn't care what anybody thinks, which is really my sister, how she was.
Actually, she sounds more like Alexandria, because I think Alex is bolder in that particular way. I think with Samantha, first of all, in My Heart's Desire, she's 15 years old. She's very wise beyond her years, but she's still a young and sheltered girl, and I think that she's got the fortune that Alex didn't have of growing up in a family where her father loved her and her big brother, Drake, who she worships. She absolutely hero worships him. He's there to take care of her, and he loves her. So she's got a certain cocoon of familial kind of feelings and tenderness, and that's a plus for her. But she has yet to really grow up. And then in the 3 years from My Heart's Desire to Samantha, their years, not so much our years, she goes from being that young 15-year-old girl to being a 18-year-old young woman. You know, in those days, you were very much a woman at 18. It's not like today where you're still a kid and go to college and everything else. Then you're a woman ready to take on the world. But in her case, it wasn't so much rebellion that she wanted. She was a true romantic. We all can relate to that. And she wanted the man of her dreams, her hero, as she basically called it, because she was always immersed in Gothic novels and Jane Austen novels, and she just saw herself as the heroine looking for the hero. And that was what she had in mind when she went off to her first London season. The rest of the stuff was superfluous. It was just about, you know, meeting the man of her dreams, which she eventually did. Well, she actually did right away, but it didn't go quickly.
Well, if it goes too quickly, then you don't appreciate it so fast. But, you know, I met my husband in May of 19 whatever, and we got married 3 months later. So it must be something to it. You just never know.
Yes.
Yeah, it was like, he said, how'd I get stuck with you for 19 years? I go, well, what could I tell you? Could be worse. So what attracts her to Rem? And he was taken with her from start. She was like his little whatever, like an imp, you might say. So what attracted him to her right away?
I think the very things that he didn't want to attract him to her to him. It was him to her, rather. She's got a sort of, and Sally has this sort of combination, young old, and yet old in terms of her head, together. And there's a beauty about her that I think he's a very tainted guy with tons of baggage. And I think that just walking into this really seedy bar, which is what he did, and seeing her sitting there because her carriage had broken down and she was waiting for help, there was an immediate feel of attraction and also, I think, wistfulness almost, because she represented a youth that was long gone for him. Well, not long gone, he's not that old, but it's more of a, you know, a pull at the heartstrings kind of a thing, and he wanted no part of that, so he was fighting it tooth and nail. I think through most of the book, he himself had this huge fight, because he did not want in any way to let himself be vulnerable and also to take advantage of her in any way. So the poor guy suffered a lot.
Well, sometimes they have to suffer to get what they want. They can't always have it so easy.
That's right.
I mean, after all, that's exactly right. We have to tell them who rules the world, and it's not them, after all. So,
after all, you're right.
Remington was a covert agent to the Admiralty. How come he never told anybody? And what was his cover? That got me. That was really good because that provided the mystery in the book.
The thing with Rem was that during the War of 1812 itself, he was, well, actually before that, let's just say that first he captained his own ship, but he was, besides being a captain, he was traveling from ship to ship, keeping tabs on what was going on during the war for the Admiralty. So it was a covert operation, and the Crown actually was in charge of the whole thing. So he worked for England. Kind of like James Bond, if you want to look at it that way, and except at sea. And he was not permitted, nor did he plan to let anybody in on the fact that he was doing that. People thought that he was now training officers, naval officers for the future, et cetera, but he was not in any way, you know, suspected of doing what he was doing, because now that he's landed, he's continuing to work for the Crown, but there have been a series of incidents where naval ships have gone down, merchant ships have gone down, people have lost cargo, people have lost lives, and they can't determine what the cause is. It wasn't weather. They can't prove it wasn't pirating, but they can't yet figure out that it was. And there's no reason for this to continue happening. The ships were well made. So his job, in essence, when this book begins, which again is a covert operation for the Crown, which is why nobody knows about it, it's completely done under secrecy, is for him to figure out, with the help of his men, the guys he works with, or who work for him, I should say, exactly what's going on so that he can restore life, order, and health to the country. If that's as close to a quick explanation as I can give.
Well, we don't want to tell them too much. Now do we know? So explain, Samantha and her brother Drake were very close. So does he have any of the same qualities? Are they the same? Is that why she was attracted to him? Was he reminds her of her brother? And what does Drake, well, we don't going to get to that one just yet, but I guess I wonder what attracted her to Rem? Was it the fact that he reminded her of Drake?
No, I don't think that was the case at all. That's kind of icky, the thought of that.
Yeah,
The only thing that I think that they definitely have in common, and you're right about the similarity, is that they're both extremely stubborn, strong, and they have baggage. But Drake is much more bombastic. He's much more, it's kind of what's on your lung is on your tongue, as the expression goes. He just is, and he says what he means, and if he's angry, it just flies. Whereas Rem is much more self-contained. His anger sizzles beneath the surface, and when it erupts, it erupts. But I think that she had this innate click the minute he walked into the bar. She saw him, and that was it. It was in walked the man of her dreams. That's the first sentence, and it wasn't just he was gorgeous, which of course he is, and it wasn't even that kind of commanding presence he has. It's also that she just had this feeling that this was the right guy. And later on, seeing some of the similarities in temperament, because there are a lot of scenes between Drake and Rem as the book unravels for various reasons. Some we'll talk about, some we won't. But
that's true.
But I think that that only lends kind of an interesting layer to it, because she's caught between two men who are so similar, one that she worships all of her life and who's so protective of her, which is almost laughable. The things that he's protective about are the very things that are the very rules he broke when he went after his little virgin Alexandria 3 years earlier, but he didn't see any of that because now it's his baby sister. But I think that once the two guys sort of meet, you can see the similarities and the differences. But Sammy sees them very differently and loves them both, but is caught in the middle and is very exasperated, and I don't really blame her.
No, I don't blame her either. But her ally was Lady Alexandria. She liked her. They're very close. Not that close in age, but they're just very close. As sister-in-laws, that's rare, isn't it?
Yes, very, very.
Yeah,
I think that
tell
they,
about it.
You know, you and I talked on Tuesday about how they hit it off, because I think they saw in each other some, you know, a lot of the same vulnerabilities. But now what's happened is it's 3 years later, and Alex has grown into a very, very much a woman and a married woman and a wife. And she's now also sort of motherly towards Samantha, the same way that Drake is fatherly towards Samantha. So she sees herself, besides her friend, as kind of her big sister who has to look out for her because she has no mother. And she's so innocent and trusting that Alex takes her under her wing and takes on the role of being her older protector sister. And she's right by Drake's side and sort of being, the only difference is with woman's intuition, she's different than Drake. She doesn't have that, you know, overwhelming sense of, I'm going to protect you at all costs, and I don't care what you want, I don't care who you love, you're going to do this, this, and this, because I want you safe. She's a woman, and she can sense another woman in love, and so that makes her more, I don't know, I don't want to say softer, but I'll say more empathetic.
Yeah, that's true, because basically my mother would have said, you're going to do this, and that's how it's going to be, and my father too. They would decide if they didn't like somebody, forget it. And I think I got that from my mother. Either I like you or I don't. Right away, it's bad.
I understand that very well.
Yeah, they were always very overprotective, but for some reason, they were probably right. So when Samantha goes to London and sets her sights on Rem, she gets under his skin right away. And every time he tells her to do something, she's so cool, she does the opposite. So how does she do that? I mean, and she gets away with it. That's the funny part.
It is, because in her mind, she made up her mind that not only does she want her hero, but in order to be worthy of her hero, she has to be his heroine. So in her mind, what she's doing is not so much disobeying what he would want her to do. It's taking care of him, which is almost laughable on one level, but it's true on another, because he... all the ways in which he's vulnerable, he doesn't see, and she does. So she's wise beyond her years and decides that she's going out there and taking care of business to make sure that he's safe, and also to make sure that she solidifies this relationship that she knows is right, whether he knows it or not. And that usually ends up with her doing everything he doesn't want her to do. And certainly all the ways in which he's doing things that put his life at risk, he certainly doesn't want her involved, and she has no idea what those things are. And she keeps stumbling into them because she's making sure he's safe and not knowing why, but she's out there doing things that then put her in danger and flip him out because he's furious. So it's kind of amusing to watch.
I know, it's kind of comical too. Then I would say to her, you don't think, you need to start thinking, be a little bit more creative, don't just, you know. And she gets herself into a lot of trouble. So the fun part was when they tried to introduce her to other people. That was hilarious. How did you create these two guys? I mean, I wouldn't want any part of them either. They were horrible.
No, they were horrible, and especially one of them. But the one that was, the Viscount Anders, who's the one who's probably most prominent.
Yeah, he was evil. Oh, yeah.
Not only was he evil, but the thing is that he was going after her. You know, he was pulling out all the stops. He was going after her. He wanted her. He wanted to marry her. That was it. And it was for all the wrong reasons, because he would just have tainted her spirit and put her in a little chattel box. And she, being the way she was, which was so innocent and incapable of being cruel to anyone, just didn't know how to make him go away. She just was sort of telling him gently, this is not happening. We're just going to be friends, but that's all. And he was sort of there, you'll learn to love me. And that not only was difficult for her, but, oh, boy, did it make Rem's fuse blow every time he would see them together. He would just, you know, there's a part where Anders buys her a really beautiful necklace of, you know, jewels and everything else. And he gives it to her, and Rem comes to call on her unexpectedly right around that time. And when he sees that necklace, I wouldn't want to be in that room with him. He just really, really glows and tells her, take it off, get rid of it, and get rid of him, because it's over. And before it starts, I don't want him anywhere near you. And he tells Anders the same thing in no uncertain terms, that, you know, you come near her, I'm going to be choking you to death, so be prepared, because she's not yours. And everybody is sort of, well, then whose is she? Is she yours? And, of course, he's not willing to say yes, because he hasn't said that to himself. So it's just, it's again, it's another situation where he sees her not only in emotional danger, but actually for some reasons in physical danger, and he doesn't know what to do to make Anders go away, because Sammy is just not the kind of person to say, you know, look, I don't like you. You're not my type. I don't want any part of you. Get out of my house. That's just not her style. So it's pretty difficult.
She's got to learn to do that. It comes naturally after a while.
And she didn't have a lot of help in terms of, you know,
no.
Usually when you go on your, you go after your first London season, you've got a chaperone, and she has, she has her Aunt Gertie, who.
I know, Aunt Gertie was cool, though.
Aunt Gertie is a sweetheart, but she's a sort of a dotty elderly woman who's part deaf. More than part deaf. She mishears everything Samantha says. And she's in her own sweet world, but she has no handle on reality. And she thinks that these two lovely men who are courting Samantha are just great guys. And she doesn't. And half the time that she accompanies her to different parties, she falls asleep in the carriage. So she's snoring in the carriage, unaware of the fact that there's people that are unsavory that are courting Samantha. So she doesn't have a chaperone. And then, of course, there's Smitty, who you and I talked about at length, you know, on Tuesday.
Yeah,
but
I love Smitty.
He's now,
Smitty's so cool.
He's now transitioned from being the person who was Drake's first mate and his valet to being Sammy's overseer, because he's the one who takes her to London and is more or less her fatherly figure when she comes out for the first time, because Drake and Alex are unable to be there because Alexandria is about to give birth to their second child. So she's in bed. Drake is by her side, not necessarily to her pleasure sometimes. She tosses him out when he gets too emotional and overpowering. But Sammy's pretty much in the hands of an elderly dotty aunt and a poor middle-aged gentleman who has absolutely no idea how to handle this kind of thing. So she's on her own in a lot of ways, in ways that most young women in that era and of that breeding does not have the opportunity to be.
No, I can understand that, because most of the time when I went out, I had to be in crowds, in groups, never alone.
Yep.
Until I graduated college at 18, I wasn't even then. My parents said, when you're 21, you'll go out by yourself, maybe. And then they had to know where I was every minute. And, of course, if you didn't have a phone or something, forget it. And they would panic and send out the FBI to go find you. So, yeah, I can understand that. And Samantha, of course, should have used about 7 chaperones. And I don't even know if they could have tamed her.
They probably couldn't.
Probably couldn't. No, she's just her, I'm telling you, she's rambunctious. Within this novel, they have another plot, one involving missing sailors and ships. How does this intertwine with the main plot? That really made it, you know, even better. Because I figured if you're going to do a novel, it's not going to just be romance. You're going to have a little mystery and murder in it. Otherwise, what would
it
be?
Yeah, I always do. I always say that if there was such a thing as a bookshelf that could rack historical romantic suspense, that's what I felt like these should be, because they always are. And I like people to know that in case they're mystery fans, or, you know, if the event that they're not, then obviously this isn't for them. But the situation is interesting because, yeah, the first time around with My Heart's Desire, it was more of a ships at sea, because, I mean, first of all, let's start with the fact that Drake's family, it has a shipbuilding company, and that's at the root of both these books. So in this one, it's, you know, Drake's company has manufactured some of the, well, at least one of the ships that went missing. And since Rem has to work on finding those ships, he goes to Drake for conversation and to interview him in a lot of ways, because they're all checking. Remember, when ships disappear at sea and the cargo is lost, then the owners go to Lloyd's and they collect insurance money on the missing cargo. So there's a lot of, you know, concern about why is that, was there insurance fraud, so to speak, going on? Is that what, you know, it wasn't called that then, but that's effectively what it was. And so he went to talk to Drake to sort of feel him out, see what he knew, see if he knew anything, see if he had any feeling about who might be involved in this, just from a layperson standpoint, who was the owner of this company. Of course, Drake took great offense to that, because he thought he was implying that he knew something illegal, and of course he did not. That's just not Drake. But it did tie together nicely, the two men meeting each other and the plot of the book, you know, mingling together with the storyline between Samantha and Remington, because it drew in her family business, and it also drew in the fact that one of the ways in which Rem at least told himself, it was part true, but mostly not, that he was courting her, or with her as much as he was because he was hoping to learn more about Barrett's shipping and more about what she might know about the missing ships, which of course she didn't. But that didn't stop her, because once she knew that it was Barrett's shipping that was involved, she was all in. So she was not the type of thing to dick, that's for sure. But I think
I would wonder what would happen if you made her a covert agent.
Yeah, wouldn't that be interesting? Either the Admiralty would love it, or they would blow up. I mean physically blow up. I don't mean yell.
I know. So who is Boyd, and how does he come into play with Remington? Because
he's one of my favorite secondary characters. I love Boyd.
Yeah.
He served with Rem during the war, and they became the best of friends. They really are almost like brothers. They care deeply for each other. Boyd owns that seedy tavern that Rem meets all of his covert ops in. And so he works with Rem, or you could say for Rem, but I don't think Rem sees it that way. He sees them as working together on all of the missions that the Crown sends to him to handle. So they're together in that regard. And they also work with a couple of Bow Street runners, which you and I will talk about, I know, in a minute. And so they're best friends, and they're also obviously business associates. That's the best way to handle, you know, that. And then, of course, the bar, the tavern, does belong to Boyd as well. So it's a livelihood, as well as a, you know, a great place to have all of the covert meetings that they need to have when no one suspects, because they're all, you know, the clientele is highwaymen and, you know, then seafaring guys, and it's a very, you know, raucous bar where everybody's drunk and happy, and they really aren't looking around to see who's meeting with whom. And everyone who meets makes sure to look a certain way so that they fit into the decor. As far as Rem, they all know who he is. They don't know what he does, but they all know that he's a nobleman. They all know that he's also capable of breaking any one of them in half if he chooses to, so they all accept him. And he's just a regular figure around the place. And as far as Boyd, they know nothing except he's the tavern keeper. So it works well in terms of what they need to do covertly.
So what happens when Rem and Drake? What happens when Drake finds out that Rem is interested in Samantha? Because he's not thrilled about that. Yeah, it's like my brother, when I introduced him to anybody, and he's younger, he's like, forget it, you don't want to go out with that one either. So, yeah, what happens when these two get together in the same room? They hate each other.
Well, the first thing is that when they first meet, Rem doesn't say anything because he doesn't even understand his own feelings, and he sticks to business. So what happens in the meantime is that Lord Hartley, who's a more or less, I'm trying to give pieces away without giving other pieces away, he was extremely, extremely close friends with Drake's father when he was alive. He's an older gentleman. And he's also got a similar company. So he feels sort of paternal in his own way toward the entire Barrett family, because Grayson is gone. That's Drake's father. And he's feeling very paternal. And he comes to London. I'm sorry, he leaves London and goes to Allenshire to talk to Drake and says, I guess you know what you're doing, but because Rem has let everyone think that he was asked by Drake to take care of Samantha and keep an eye on her. So poor Lord Hartley steps in it by saying, you know, I guess you understand what, you know, what you're doing. And Drake is like, what? And he said, well, you know, he is, I guess, protecting her from places, from people like, you know, Viscount Anders, and he is a womanizer, so I understand. And but, you know, Drake is, you know, Rem is kind of a womanizer too. And Drake just blows. He says, you telling me my sister is cavorting with both these people? And he does, you know, what Drake does. He flies off the handle, jumps in a carriage, and goes to London to kill everybody. And it's only Alex trying to, please, calm down, hear what Sammy has to say before you go ballistic. And he, you know, she's the only soft spot in his heart, so he tries, but he's not terribly successful because he bursts into the townhouse, you know, his London townhouse where Sammy and Smitty and everybody are staying. And the first thing he does was accost poor Smitty. It drags him into the room and gives him the fifth degree about what are you letting happen. And Smitty is caught in an awful position because he loves both of them, you know, and he cares for the family so much. And he basically says honestly to him, please, my lord, you know, excuse me, in this case, your grace, don't put me in this position. And Sammy walks into the room and says, I can speak for myself. What is going on? And he directly asks her, are you seeing these people? And she just announces, yes, I'm marrying Rem. And this didn't go. She planned on marrying him and was announcing it to everybody even before it came to pass. So he didn't know they were getting married until later on, but she did. So at that point, it actually, that more or less was about to happen. But still, she had no qualms about just telling this. And when Drake then just blew up, she was completely, and the way Sammy always is, puzzled. I mean, why are you yelling? I'm telling you that I love this man. We're getting married. He's coming to ask your permission. I don't get it. And he starts screaming at her, you're not marrying him. You're not staying here another minute. I'm taking you back to Allenshire. It would be this minute. Smitty, pack your bags. We're going home. That's Drake. That's what I meant by him being different than Remington, because he's more controlled and has had to be because he's been a spy and you can't just, you know, let loose the way Drake can. But he does drag her home the way you just described your family. He dragged her home and sort of kept her in that his gilded place there and was livid. He was not allowing this to happen by any way. And I think also the moment that it was sort of, he kind of forgave him was when she turned her back on him and said, I'm not listening to you, and went out and slammed the door, and he looked after her. And it was sort of this kind of heartfelt moment where it was like, she's never turned her back on me before. She's never run away from me before. And she's never out and out denied, you know, disobeyed me that way before. He was crushed because this is his little sister. And I think Smitty, as usual, being the voice of reason, told him, you know, just give her some time. But I think that hurt, you know, that moment of hurt on Drake's part was, it makes him a more believable, vulnerable character, because he is. I mean, he comes across like all fire and brimstone, but he loves her dearly, and this is all done with love in his heart. So he's just completely taken aback and furious and everything else. And you know, of course, who's the one who's going to soften him up. It's going to be Alexandria, because she always does.
This little princess, that's right. Sometimes you have only, you know, there's like one person that could actually get through to somebody, whereas no one else can. But Samantha, I mean, basically he's not her father. And basically he brought her up because the father died in the first one, and then the mother wasn't there. So it made it kind of difficult for her. So at least she didn't turn around and say, I'm never speaking to you again. But he probably thought that. So the other character that I thought was really cool was Millie. And poor Samantha didn't want a maid. She just didn't want her. So poor Millie, what was her problem? She didn't want to do it either.
Millie basically used to work for Aunt Gertie in her home, because now, you know, Aunt Gertie has come here to take care of things, supposedly. And the cook was her mother, and she, actually I think she was her aunt. And she helped a lot around the house, and she was more of a, not a serving girl, but in a lot of ways she was, you know, assistant to the maid kind of thing. And she loved it. She arranged flowers. She did all kinds of things, but she'd never actually been a lady's maid to anyone. And she just didn't take to it. Here she was brought along, and it was like, okay, you're going to be Lady Samantha's maid. And she really liked Samantha a great deal. Samantha didn't know what to do because, as you just said, she didn't want a maid. She wanted as much freedom to do as she could because she wanted to have Graham, and this was just another impediment, so she couldn't get out there and do what she wanted to do. But she was kind and very caring to Millie, but Millie just did everything wrong. She was all thumbs. She couldn't help her pick out a dress. There was one day she just destroyed her hair when she was trying to get it together.
I know, that was hilarious.
A date with Rev.
That was.
And I felt so badly for her because she just kept crying. And, you know, she just kept saying, I'm no good at anything. And finally, Samantha just bluntly asked her, you know, do you not want to do this? And, you know, if you could go back and go back to your former job, would you do it? And she was weeping and saying, you know, yes, I'm so sorry. It's not you. I really like you so much. But you, and Samantha said, I understand completely. Done. I mean, you can go back and do what it is that you were doing before and be happy. And Millie was so elated. She was kissing her and hugging her. And I think she was out of the house in about 4 seconds, back in the carriage and going back to her and to Aunt Gertie's place. But, you know, you have to feel for this poor girl. She wasn't trained. This is not what she was brought up to be. And she was a very, you know, I don't mean simple in the sense of being stupid. I mean simple in the sense of being very, you know, easy in the world and easy in her skin and wanted just the simple things in life. And this is what she did. So she had no interest whatsoever in coming up in the world to be, you know, the lady of the house's maid. This was not what she wanted. It was, I kind of felt sorry for her. She was such a young girl and so scared, and she didn't want to come right. In those days, you certainly didn't come right out and say, I don't care for my employment. So I felt bad for her. Yeah, I thought she was kind of cool, too, and I was so relieved for her when she got to go home.
Yeah, well, you know, some of these young girls, even now, accept their lot in life. Instead of looking at the bigger picture and saying, I can get ahead, they just accept things and get complacent and don't do anything about it. And that's what's really sad, because they don't have an anchor or anything like that to tell them. So poor Millie leaves. Why did she pick Cynthia from Annie's place? And why did she think she was unworthy? Now, that was really amazing. I said, oh, my God, these two together? Ay, ay, ay.
How can you not love Cynthia? I mean, she's just so special. Annie's.
Yeah, she was.
Annie's is a brothel, and it's a place that's frequented by Rem and Boyd for obvious reasons until he meets Samantha, but also for not obvious reasons, because a lot of times that's where they sit down with the two Bow Street runners that they work with, and they talk with them about, I probably should explain what a Bow Street runner is, because probably half the people listening are probably thinking, you know, what is that? Because unless you, you know, research the time thoroughly, that's not something that you would know. The Bow Street runners were the original police force in London. There actually were only 6 of them when they first started, and they grew to be, and the truth is that they found that term very insulting. They didn't call themselves the Bow Street Runners. They just worked on Bow Street, and they were the police. But that was just a nickname that the public came up with, because they were always – it was kind of like a U.S. Marshal would be. They were always off catching the bad guys. Phenomenal job. This is way before Scotland Yard or anything like that. And Rem basically picked 2 of them that were of the best, and they worked with him. They were paid. They were paid nicely on the side, but it was not ugly things they were doing. They were helping him solve these crimes and find the truth and get the bad guys, so to speak. So they were doing a service to their country as well, but they were doing this off the books, if you want to look at it that way. The Admiralty knew. I mean, the Admiralty sanctioned all of this, because the whole idea was that they were doing things the legal way, and Rem could do things the cross-the-line way, so he could do it any way that needed it to be done just to get what they needed to get, and in this case, it was solving the crime of the missing ships. So he would meet with, getting back to Annie's, he would meet with Boyd and the Bow Street runners that he worked with, and they would sit down and discuss things, and nobody looked at them, because men in a brothel were men in a brothel. They came to drink and gamble and have a great time and then take one of the women and went to one of the rooms and have a good time. So that was the situation in terms of the setup. Annie is cool unto herself because she runs this great place, and yet she's still very, very human. I always kind of pictured, dating myself, but I always kind of pictured Joan Blondell in like Gunsmoke or something, that kind of buxom blonde woman who just so shrewd and ran the place with an iron fist, with an understanding heart. And Cynthia came there. It was certainly her first trip to any brothel whatsoever to work there, but it's almost hard, you know, her story being so heartbreaking. In short, she worked for a nobleman, and she worked in his home as a governess, and she was raped. There's no other way to put it. In those days, it was perfectly allowable. It was like, okay, the nobleman had his way with one of the servants, but he raped her, and she had no one to go to say that to, because no one would have cared or believed her. So he told her that if she dared tell anyone, that he would basically blacklist her so she could work nowhere for the rest of her life. So she said nothing, but now she was ruined, and her parents wanted no part of her, and no one wanted any part of her. She was a fallen woman. And so in order to make any money, she did what she had to do, which was go work in the only place she felt suited to work, or actually was suited to work, unless she found someone very compassionate, which nobody would be, because it's rampant rumors, and there's no way that she can get out of it. London society was, you know, rampant with gossip. So she went to Annie's and got a job there and was mortified. I mean, she just was, her eyes were downcast. She felt like worthless, and she did what she had to do, but with a broken heart, and had a horrible opinion of men, and I don't really blame her. So I think that, just to touch on a fun note that you and I, you know, we're probably going to touch on anyway, the person who is going to meet her and change her mind about men is going to be Boyd, because he has that kind of patience and compassion and understanding to get it. But at this point, no one gets it. And Sammy, she has jumped on, basically she's gotten herself in the back of a carriage to Annie's, because she knows that Rem is on his way there, and she thinks that she's off to protect him from something that he's going to do. She doesn't think he's just going there to cavort with a woman. She's going to see what he's going to do, because she thinks he's in trouble, always. In this case, she also thinks that he's financially in debt. She just always is worried about him and thinking it's her job to take care of him. So off she goes. She's standing behind a brothel with no care for her own safety, no thought that anyone would want to hurt her. And these quote-unquote lovely gentlemen approach her and start to use today's terms, come on to her. And they're about to take her into an alley and rape her. It takes a while before she picks up on it, but she does. And she tries talking herself out of it, and it doesn't work. And she's backed into a corner. And Cynthia comes out, sees what's going on, and just blasts the guys with this, "What are you doing? This is one of Annie's girls. And how could you do this? You know what Annie is going to do." And they just blanch, because Annie is Annie. She's, you know, in charge of that area. It's sort of like her place, and nobody messes with her girls. And they realize it, and, oh, my God, we didn't know. We didn't know she was, a lovely courtesan who works in this brothel. We're gone. And they take off. So she saves Sammy's life. And Sammy sees in her the qualities that Boyd sees in her, even though she doesn't know her story yet. And she just, on the spot, asks her to come home with her. You know, leave, come home with me. And she asks her to be her lady's maid. She said, you know, will you come? It will work. I know this will work. And Cynthia is all about, I'm not worthy, and there's no way they would accept me. Mm-hmm. And she talks her into it by telling her that Smitty will hear that she saved her life, and that will be the end of it. She'll be immediately accepted into the family. So that's what happens. And, you know, Samantha makes happen what Samantha makes happen. So it's sort of fortuitous, because it works well that it's like Millie is out and Cynthia's in. And it's great because they are very fast friends, and that's wonderful. It's not great because, being Cynthia's background, being what it is, and her feelings for Samantha, and Samantha's feelings for Rem, this is kind of A equals B, B equals C, and A then equals C. Cynthia is all about, no way, you're going out and doing this, and I'm going to stop you from it. So there's another roadblock to what Samantha wants to accomplish. So as much as she loves her, this is not great. So it's a very interesting friendship. Cynthia is a very complex and sort of a wonderful human being. And it's also very interesting when Rem meets her under her new role as Samantha's lady's maid for the first time, because he's seen her at Annie's, and he assumes that she's just one of the courtesans who works there, and her story is like any other. And then she steps out of the carriage as Samantha's lady's maid when they're out at Vauxhall, and he sort of blanches and says nothing. But Samantha tells him, I know who she is, I know where she came from, and I don't think you understand. I understand very well. That's one of those moments, again, where Samantha shows that she's a woman. She's not a child. She gets it. Her life has had other things in it that have been dark and ugly. So it hasn't been Drake and it hasn't been Alex or their father, but there are other things that have happened in her life that have hardened her in certain ways, too. So she gets it. She may not be hard-hearted, but she gets it. And she understands life a lot better than Rem thinks she does. That's one of those moments.
A lot better than a lot of people. A lot better than a lot of people do today. It's like a test of wills. But before I forget, because we have about 15 more minutes left, one more. Next Monday.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Next Monday on October 31st, Halloween, Bruce Coffin will be here with Among the Shadows. That's a really scary book. We have on 12/8, we have one of my favorite people, John Lang, Strong Cold Dead. On November 16th, we have the author of The Neely Girl. We have on the 21st, we have the author of Skin of Tattoos and A Life is a Life by Lisa McDaniels. And we've got on 12/15, Offstage Left. And on the 19th, we're going to have the author of Bullet Under the Blue Sky. And that should be interesting. And then we start on January 3rd. I am very honored that the author of An Unexpected Prisoner, Robert Weidman, agreed to interview with me. He's a POW survivor of the Vietnam War. And he was in the POW camp in Hanoi for 6 years. And the story, I finished it like in a couple of hours yesterday. You have to hear it. It's amazing. I'm so honored that he agreed to interview with me. So that's one book that I would suggest, and the other one is the history of what happened to the Sioux Indians, and it's called Yellow Hair by Andrew Joyce, and that was another one. Both books are like 500 pages. I read them both yesterday, seriously, and finished them both. And once you start one, you can't put it down. And the atrocities that were done for the Indians, and if you listen to the news today, they're trying to do the same today to the Sioux Indians. So you have to read it. It's fantastic. So. We have what happens when Drake decides to. I have no idea who this is, and I don't care. What happens when when Rem tells her to stay with Alexandria and Drake, and she decides to skip out, and she decides that she wasn't going to listen to him, which is scary.
Well, that's probably a really crucial moment, because when she decides that she needs to tell him what's going on, that Drake knows and that everything that's happening, and she's not leaving without talking to him, she of course takes off for his townhouse, finds out that he's, she cajoles the butler into telling her where he is, finds out he's at Boyd's, and runs off to Boyd's to talk to him. And he and Boyd are alone, and they're discussing the fact that Rem can no longer feel comfortable using Samantha in any way to find out information about Barrett shipping. Mm-hmm. And she overhears that from the other side of the door, and they kind of come face to face with her saying to him, I don't know you at all. What are you doing? And you know, it's one of those scenes mm-hmm. that could result in, which is one of my pet peeves. I hate misunderstandings, those kinds of misunderstandings
mm-hmm.
where
yeah.
someone leaves you a letter on a pillow and it flies away and you never know, that kind of thing where, I don't like that. And she just comes right out and says, tell me that what I'm thinking isn't true. And he says, what you're thinking isn't true. I didn't use you. What I'm feeling for you has nothing to do with this. And all she asks of him is to be honest with her about that, and also to say that whatever he's doing doesn't involve trying to harm Drake in any way, which he does assure her because he's not. And he said, then, will you just believe me? And she said, yes, I just believe it. She takes him on faith, which is pretty humbling. And she actually does go home after she tells him what's going on, that Drake knows, that he's furious, that he's not going to be listening to Rev anytime soon. And so he says, go home, go back to Allenshire with Drake and with Alec. Be with them, and I'll come for you when it's safe and when it's time, and just believe that. Tell them that you need time, that's why we're apart, and stay there. And this is the one time she does listen to him, because she understands that this is coming to a head. And she goes home with Drake and Alex, with Drake actually and Smitty to where Alex is, and spends time with them, which is extremely important anyway, because it gives her time to talk to Alex and Alex to understand what's going on. And that's crucial to probably the next part of what we'll talk about. But that's why she eventually listens to him. But she, as usual, is cavorting around the seediest parts of London in the dark, alone, with nobody with her. And that's Sammy.
She's lucky she didn't get worse. She's lucky she just, that Cynthia came out. And she's lucky, eventually. Okay, I could see her running a major corporation and telling all the men what to do.
Yes,
and
I could.
God help them if they don't.
Imagine if she and Alex were partners.
Imagine if it was in the 21st century. And
yes.
It was now, yeah. It would be interesting. So one of the other things I wanted to talk before we close was some of the scenes at the dances were hilarious. And she got stuck dancing with someone. How did you create her reaction? Because, we've all been on blind dates and we've all met people that we, try to be polite, but, oh, my God, I can't stand you from the minute you walk over to me and you're obnoxious. So how did she dance with someone that she couldn't stand? Especially, well, the vice count was one, but the other guy was worse.
Yeah, well, I think that the bottom line is that she sort of did one thing, and that was think about Rem. So it was kind of a bite. She obviously learned how to dance, so it was going through the motions. But she was busy wondering where Rem was. Is he coming? Is he going to be there? Oh, look, he just walked through the door. That's everything that she's about. So she's doing everything by rote. That's what she's supposed to be doing. But until she actually lands the guy of her dreams, she's going through the motions of what her brother and her aunt have decided she's supposed to do. But that, I think that she distracts herself by thinking about where Rem is at all times. That's how she gets through it.
Oh, that's amazing. So how did you design this cover of the Gold Chariot? And what did the other one look like 25 years ago?
The original cover of the book was a die cut, which is sort of like there's a front cover and then there's a hole and there's an inside cover is the best way to describe it. And the outside was a fireworks sunburst kind of a thing. So it exploded and it was in the shape of a sunburst. And it was really, when you opened it, the two of them were, that it was taken from the scene at Vauxhall where they have their first really intense physical encounter. So and the fireworks do go off there. It's the gardens, famous gardens in London, and fireworks do go off there at night. So that's how the original was designed. But when we redesigned this one, this to me, I don't know, I just thought of this. This one was on my own, and I thought of this and said, this has to be. This is a Cinderella story, and what I want is a carriage that looks like a Cinderella carriage. And so the artist took a genuine carriage of the times and sort of modeled it into kind of Fabergé-looking carriage that has a Cinderella look to it. And I love that feeling, because that to me is ultimately what this is.
That is amazing, because everyone wants a gold chariot. Everyone in the whole world.
Yeah, everyone wants a hero too.
Yeah, well, you do, because you go, you go out on your first date and you have all these, things in your mind. Oh, what do I do? How do I act? Oh, it's going to be wonderful, and it's either the best time of your life or it could actually destroy you, because
no,
you just don't know. You're right, because, it can either, you have to have a mindset of, if it works out, okay, and if it doesn't, oh, well, it doesn't matter. And that's hard.
But that's very hard, especially for Samantha. And I think that it was very crucial, in terms of emotionally the ending, having all of them together. Alex standing up to her 5 feet height and telling Rem, you know, if you tell me that you love her, then I'll go in there and fight for you. But if you are using her, I'm going to make sure you wish you were never born, which is Alex. And all of them just, you know, coming together and all the emotional things of Alex giving birth and all of them together learning how to make this work. I think that the emotional culmination here is as important as the plot culmination. It all happens together, but, you know, and of course there's little Gray, which I cried when I wrote that scene, and I think I cry every time I reread that scene.
Yeah, little Gray. Oh,
do we have time for that one, or do we not have time for that one?
Yes, we do. We have time. Tell everybody about little Gray. He's so cute.
Yeah, he's just such an adorable. He's their firstborn, and My Heart's Desire, actually, Alex is pregnant with him. And so he's 2 years old now, and actually, you know, sort of two plus. But he's named after Drake's father, Grayson, so it's little Gray. And he is in the gardens when Rem leaves after their first meeting, he and Drake. He finds Gray in the garden, vehemently pulling flowers up out of the garden, out of the flower beds. And he is not much with children because he's never been around them, but he squats down and says, you know, he recognizes him as Drake's son right away because he's got that black hair and those emerald green eyes, and he just looks like his father. And he asks him why he's doing that. And in little two-year-old talk, he more or less says, you know, Mommy, give me brother or sister, I give her flowers. And you know, Rem kind of has tears in his eyes because it's just so moving. And he does a really wonderful thing that I think shows one of the really beautiful, tender sides of Rem. As all boys are, little boys, they want a brother. They have no use for a little girl. He's like, no, that's not really what I have in mind, in his mind's eye. So he tells him, I want brother. Rem tells him all about, you know, what do you think of your Aunt Sammy? And he says, oh, you know, he tells him about how, again, in two-year-old talk, he says how she loves Drake so much and he's her hero. And Rem tells him, you know, it's a wonderful thing to have a little sister who thinks you're her hero. And wouldn't you want one of those instead of just a brother? You could have a little sister who worships you that way and that you could be her hero. So by the time little Bonnie is born, that's all he wants. He runs off happily to tell his mother, oh, I want a sister, I want a sister, and that's what he's gotten, a sister. So it not only gets a chance, you get a chance to meet Gray, who's just a precious little boy, but you get a chance to see Rem and in a softer capacity. I love that scene. I cry through it every time I reread it.
I did also come to think of it because, you know, a little kid that's so sensitive at 2.5 years old, that's amazing. But are you going to write, is there another book in this series that I haven't seen? Is there a third one?
No, that's it. It's just these two because we ran out of, well, we know why we didn't write a book on Sebastian. So we ran out of Barrett, and Alex was an only child. So, you know, it's this kind of thing where I don't actually decide to write a sequel or a series. It just happens. And it's from the minute Samantha appeared on the page, it's My Heart's Desire. I just knew. And then my readers started clamoring for it. And that's probably one of my most, if not my most popular historical, is Samantha. I think for the very reason I just said. I mean, how can you resist Didn't Walk the Man of Her Dreams? But there isn't. That's the series. That's the Barrett family series in and unto itself.
Oh, I thought maybe you're going to write one with Gray when he gets older.
Well, I don't think I haven't thought about it. I mean, that never went away. I always have possibilities in my mind's eye about the next generation. I've done that in previous books that I've written, you know, and where I've written, like The Last Duke did that, you know, it was a situation where I started with one couple and then moved on to their children later on. So, yeah, that does happen. You know, with me, I never say never.
Yeah, well, you never know because there's Gray and Bonnie, and then there's, of course, there's Rem's children or they can fight for the throne or whatever. Okay, so where can everyone learn more about you and your work? And tell us what's next in the murder field because, you know, that's my big thing, murder books.
That's mine too. You can find everything about me, my books, and all of my links to social media on AndreaCain.com. So you can communicate with me in any way you choose, obviously. You can also sign up for my email newsletter. So you can do all that right on AndreaCain.com. And as far as what I'm writing now, I'm in the middle of, I think I'm on the sixth book of the Forensic Instinct series, and I'm writing that very excitedly because they're a very special team. And when we talk about those books, you and I will get into that more. Mm. But it's a, you know, it's an ensemble of investigators that are in today's world. So these are all contemporary suspense thrillers. And I love writing them. I loved writing my historicals. I love writing these. And I was fortunate enough that my readership sort of transitioned with me.
Well, actually, we could tell that you love writing, and I love reading your work. And I'm really lucky that Partners in Crime didn't listen to me and just sent me the books anyway. I keep telling them I'm booked, and they keep telling me, no, you're not. And they keep telling me, could you do this? And I go, like, okay. But they're amazing.
And you're a miracle worker, and somehow you find a way.
Somehow, you know, it's funny. My mother made me read 10 books every week, seriously, plus taking violin, piano, and Hebrew lessons and everything else, and 90 hours of homework and studying every day. And somehow, I always loved to read. And when I decided to become a book reviewer, like I said on Tuesday, my sister dared me to review a cookbook, and I don't know what end of a knob of a stove does. I have no clue whatsoever. I can basically use a microwave, and that's about it. I reviewed Martha Chief's Stir Lift.
The same way.
Well, my husband used to laugh at me when we lived in the Bronx and said, you know, well, you know, is reservations. I said, no, actually, I only know is takeout and call it in, which I did before.
I was just
going to
say
weather.
That. We know all the takeout menus.
Yep. I called in for my salad and my grilled chicken because I watch what I eat. And I got him whatever he wants. And, yeah, I know. The guy at the
That's
pizza
exactly
place knows when I call. Yeah, see, that's exactly right. And I called this morning, said, send me my fruit salad, send me this, and send me that. And I made friends with a new guy up here, and they love me. I call at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they bring it at 8. I mean, like little princess here. I think I'm my own Samantha in some ways. So this has been fun. And when is this new one coming out, the next murder book coming out, so I can pencil you? I am booked until the end of February, people. Seriously.
Well, I think this is probably coming out in the fall of 2017. So
okay.
We have some
I have to remember that. So which books,
you know,
which books of yours haven't I read yet?
Of the thrillers?
Yeah, which ones? I read The Murder That Never Was. I couldn't put that down. Oh, my God.
Okay, that was the fifth one. The first one is The Girl Who Disappeared Twice. That's the first one of the series.
Oh, I never
and
read
from
that.
There, it's The Line Between Here and Gone, The Stranger You Know, and The Silence That Speaks. That's all the four that precede this one, The Murder That Never Was.
Well, you have to send me the first one.
Oh, definitely.
Because send me the first one so I could start from the beginning, okay?
Absolutely. That way you'll meet the Forensic Instincts team when they first form. You'll love it.
Okay, I will. Because if it's murder and you wrote it, I know I'm going to love it. So thank you so very much. And
the
first one, I will let you know. Oh, I emailed a few authors, and I was going to, I think I emailed you the list of the panel shows. And
yes,
we've got Robert Tigoni said yes. And Larry Farmer said yes. And Alan Topol said yes. And Patrick Gary said yes. And I'm waiting for a few more. But basically, they said yes for number six, which is writing in the first-person narrative or whatever. So whatever makes you happy, let me know. You can do all of them, some of them. And I'm going to start doing them in January. Because
great. I'm going to look over that list, but I will let you know.
Okay. Thank you so much, Andrea. Everybody have a great day. The snow's coming down. Hopefully it's not going to stick. It's going to stop. Yeah. It's like sleet and horrible out there, and that's why we're in here. And if you don't know what to do today, pick up a book and read. And you know what? Christmas is coming and Hanukkah's coming, so buy the whole set of Andrea's books, and this way you'll have plenty of books to put in people's stockings and under the menorah. Seriously.
That's a great idea. Thank you.
You're welcome, because the best present in the world for me is a book.
I love books. I've read forever just like you have.
Yeah, well, I finished two lessons. Like I said, I think they were like 12,000 words between the two books and 1,000 pages. But you know what? It's fun. So thank you very much. Have a great day, and I'll be back on Monday, Halloween, with Among the Shadows by Bruce Coffin. And be safe and watch out. And if you have little children, make sure that they don't eat the candy until they get home, and make sure that you check it first because you never know
Absolutely.
What's in it. Yeah. Okay, everybody have a nice day, and bye.
Bye-bye.